Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, June 10th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted that you could join me this evening. This evening is our precious metals market report with Franklin Sanders. First, I'm going to review the top stories in money and markets, some questions for Ask Catherine, and a brief news clip on the Gulf oil spill and Let's Go to the Movies. It was posted at the blog post. It's an interview or a presentation by Rachel Maddow. I hope you had the time to check it out. So money and markets, quite some week. Our theme for this week is rebalancing juggling act. I've talked before about rebalancing. What rebalancing is follows. For many decades, it's been the American consumer that kept the global market going, and access to the American markets and American consumers was the engine that drove a lot of America's power and force around the world. And what has been happening is we've been shifting investment into the emerging markets and into Asia, and it's really shifting it from the aging populations into the young and growing populations. And as we do that, we're shifting, we're rebalancing away from a dependency on the U.S. consumer to trying to keep the global economy going with the Asian and the emerging market consumers. And if you look at the demographics, it makes sense. At the same time, trying to make the shift is an enormous political and logistical really operation, and that's why I call it a juggling act. And it's a juggling act. If you watch this week, we had the G20 finance meetings and the Bilderberg meetings, and as you can see, even they are getting a little bit exhausted by the complexity of it and trying to run it on a centralized basis. I wanted to mention, before we get into the stories this week, I wanted to mention one of the most important things to you being successful in this kind of rebalancing situation. I've noticed sometimes when I have the same conversation with a client or a customer, and then I have it again, by the time I have it five times, I say, you know, I need to discuss this on the Soleri Report. I want every one of you to take your first name, so mine's Catherine, and then I want you to take a piece of paper, and when you review your assets, your balance sheet, your finances, your portfolio, your investments, on the top of this paper, I want you to put, I put Catherine Inc. I want you to put your first name, comma, Inc. And I want you to think of yourself as your primary asset. So you have personal spiritual power. You have health. You have intelligence. You have skills. You have people that you love and you care about and are around you and love you and support you. You have your ability to be useful and to generate revenues being useful with products and services, or lowering expenses by ways that you're helpful to others and they're helpful to you. So you have all these parts of the asset that goes into Catherine Inc. or Sally Inc. or David Inc. or Franklin Inc. And I want you to think of those as your primary investment. Your financial assets, your money, is there as a tool to help you support you. And so, yes, we want your financial assets to grow, because the more assets you have, the more resources you have to support yourself. But you're the primary asset. And in this environment, in a long-term shift from a financial bubble to tangibles, the first and most important tangible you need to be investing in is you. So when I talk about the financial markets and the money markets, look at it in the context of Catherine Inc. or Your Name Inc. as being the primary asset that we're trying to build and grow, because you're the ultimate tangible investment. Okay, one of the things we're all thinking a lot about these days is, where do we put our cash? Do we put it in municipal bonds? Well, we have the state and local government credit problems. We have now real cities and towns filing for bankruptcy or discussing it. It's getting serious. We'll see a lot more after the June 30 budgets get decided and the trickling out to the state, to the local governments for the rest of the summer. Corporate bonds, we've seen steady slide in the number of high-rated AAA corporate bonds. People are nervous about that. And, of course, in the fixed income market, interest rates are an all-time low. We're literally looking at mortgage rates at an all-time low or close to it. What's the point of taking that risk if you're not going to get any interest? stocks, if you look at all the various concerns, and we've talked about it, so I'm not going to go into it today, in the stock market, there are real risks that we could get a significant drop in the stock market, especially if this rebalancing juggling act runs into trouble. At dinner with Franklin, we were talking about the troubles in the real estate market. What happens if the banks were to begin to write off not just what they're dealing with in the residential markets? Of course, foreclosures continue to be high, but in the commercial market. So where do you put a cash? It's a big issue, and it's a big issue. I just wanted to mention the economics of the BP situation. I was on Coast to Coast News last night, and they asked me to talk about why is the investor so scared. Well, look at the BP situation. We have a stock that's fallen almost $100 billion. It was up again a little bit today. On rumors of bankruptcy, in theory, if a bankruptcy happened, you could literally see the stock lose $200 billion. But let's put that in context. We're looking at a Gulf Coast economy where the impact of the Gulf oil spill, particularly on small business, could lose a trillion or two. So shareholders lose at maximum $200 billion, but people all across the board can lose $2 trillion. So if you're in an environment where a company that you think is financially strong can wipe out $2 trillion value and be destroyed as a result of operational risk, that's a very tricky situation to invest in the stock market. One of the most important articles we put up on the blog was from Forbes this week. Let me just read a quote. It was the prophets, I called it the prophets of coup d'etat. It's in the commentary. Focus hard on this shocking Wall Street reality. The top six bank holding companies earned an aggregate of $51 billion in pre-tax income in 2009. We're talking about JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo. All of these six firms had pre-tax income attributed to their trading revenues of $59.7 billion. Now, this is stunning because what it means is they either made no money or lost money in their basic business and made all their money in proprietary trading. If you drill down and look at that proprietary trading, a great deal of it comes from either the ability to lend back to the government on a leverage basis. There's a chart on the blog posted early this week showing the skyrocketing rise of the big banks lending back to the government. The other place it's coming is trading on inside information. We've talked about that many times. And it's almost a metaphor for the whole economy because we're watching an economy where the fundamental businesses aren't making money. The people who are making money because they have the force of government behind them, whether it's a government contract or the federal credit in the case of the six big banks. So it's a real metaphor, very importantly, on what's going on in the U.S. economy. Symbols are very important. I usually ignore things that kind of rocket around the Internet, but one thing that rocketed around this week that I think is important is Obama gave a press conference on the Gulf oil situation in front of a gold curtain with no American flag. In fact, it looked like he was coming in from the gold exchange in Dubai. And this is important because this is an election year. You have a president with very strong disapproval ratings. Really, his disapproval ratings are sort of at a relative high, approval at a relative low. And yet he feels comfortable to give a press conference on the Gulf oil situation without an American flag present. A comment on the Internet is how unusual this is. It is unusual, and it's important because symbols are, in this world, very important. This is a very important symbol, and the fact that he has the confidence to do this before the election is not a good sign. A couple comments on what the polls say at Rasmussen. Voters overwhelmingly reject ideas to tax online news services, cell phones, and other electronic devices to help support the newspaper industry. The proposals were recently floated by the Federal Trade Commission. The market is clearly saying, we don't want the traditional print media anymore. And we're watching change accelerate dramatically in print media, in TV news, in the music business. Online businesses are now starting to, on an accelerated basis, take significant market share, enough to really put businesses out of business and to radically change the infrastructure. Again, you're going to see that in businesses that don't have the force of government behind them You know, so you have a defense contractor, in essence, who's got a franchise of force. You've got the six big banks who've got the federal deposit and their various roles on behalf of the federal government, including depository. But churches, schools, lots of media, they don't have that franchise of force. And it's one thing to sit in an Ivy League class and graduate with $100,000 of debt if you think sitting in history class and listening to things that are really not the real story on what happened. You know, it's one thing to do it if you think you're going to get a great job, but if you graduate with all that debt and you don't get a great job, what's the point of sitting there and being lied to? Another important statistic from Rasmussen, 58% continue to favor repeal of the health care law, a figure that includes 48% who strongly favor repeal. This is very strong, and that's going to make it interesting going into election period. As I said before, the Britons and the Germans are promoting austerity programs. There's now talk in Congress also of an austerity program. It's going to be interesting to see how that dovetails with the pressure to change healthcare. Goldman Sachs still under a lot of pressure. A new lawsuit for $1 billion from a hedge fund in Australia. Now the SEC indicates they're investigating a new CDO case. So even if Goldman settles on the first, they could end up with a whole new set of problems. And finally, Goldman, it comes out in the first quarter, sold a huge position of their BP stock. Their non-executive chairman of their international board is the former chairman of BP. Lots of swirling around that. Goldman has done an amazing job of sort of beating back the politics of the first sort of foray of being swarmed by the SEC at all. But I think this story is far from over. Again, the BP situation is very sensitive. We're going to talk, it's become more and more important to both the economy and what's happening in our culture. And so I've invited Jim Norman to speak about it next week. He's the, his interview for the oil card that we did earlier, I strongly recommend if you haven't listened to it, you go back. It was about the ability of the oil industry to manipulate and orchestrate the prices. And in retrospect, it's wonderful background for what's happening now with BP and a very important dynamic in terms of the geopolitical economic warfare that's going on. God bless the Swiss again. The lower legislative house in Switzerland has once again refused to approve the UBS bill. The Swiss have until August to approve that, or else they run into real trouble with the Department of Justice and IRS. But you know, watching the Swiss and the Department of Justice and the IRS face off is always interesting. So stay tuned. Our hero of this week is Helen Thomas, who was booted out of the Washington Press Corps as a result of some pretty funny comments she made about Israel. Helen Thomas, of course, is at 89, is famous for being quite a kind of classic member of the press, asks a lot of good questions. Very interesting this morning, or early afternoon at 12:38 today, the Washington poll, Washington Post poll asking whether Helen Thomas should be kept out of the Washington Press Corps. 88% said no, which shows you some pretty Main Street support for Helen. The only person who looked like he was having fun this week was Timmy Geithner, running around to G20 finance and around the globe looking pretty smug. Sure enough, the dollar is the safe haven, and all indications is it may continue to be. Big question, still without very good information. Lots of rumors about the possibility of war with Iran this year. I'm going to ask Franklin later what that could mean to precious metals. But it's certainly a very unstable environment, and it's one where this rebalancing juggling act is going to be quite a dance and lots of things could go wrong. Great questions and ask Catherine. Let me go through several of them. Hold on just a second while I get to that page. Let's see, is, the Clinton Chronicles, somebody mentioned the Clinton Chronicles. Are the Clinton Chronicles for real? It's a documentary about the Clintons and describes a lot of the Iran-Contra corruption. I would say that in terms of describing Iran-Contra corruption, the Clinton Chronicles are pretty useful. It is important if you look at Iran-Contra corruption to look at both. You have different packages that were done sort of from one side looking at the Clintons, from the other side looking at the Bushes. It's very important to integrate those two and understand that they were working together. And if you look at Iran-Contra on a bipartisan basis, much better. A great comment from one of our subscribers: the shutdown of European air traffic due to an invisible ash cloud looked pretty suspicious. We had comments from some subscribers that they or their families were flying in that area during the periods and saw no indication of ash cloud. It was, among other things, right after the Polish plane with the Polish leadership was shot down. One of my questions was there real concern about planes being targeted by electromagnetic weaponry, which can fritz the electronics in a plane and literally drop it out of the sky? So I agree, it did look suspicious, but the idea of canceling planes might have had a deeper reason. Okay, China bubble trouble. Is there a possibility of a bubble in China? Yes, absolutely, particularly with real estate. And if you're looking, the part of the problem in China is how do you export to the United States if the U.S. consumer isn't buying? And that's part of one of the most important stories you saw this week. It's up on the blog. It's one from the New York Times about the effort to start to raise the wages in China. And again, that's not only to rebalance the global economy, but it's to make sure that the Chinese are buying Chinese goods to try and replace the U.S. consumer, literally within the ecosystem in financial ecosystem in China. So very important dynamic. Another question: government confiscation of IRAs, 401ks, CDs, and savings account. Where is it now? There's not a lot of new news on this front. What the latest indication is what they're interested in is not confiscating 401ks and IRAs, but as you come to the point when you're withdrawing, instead of withdrawing cash, you withdraw annuity. So the way this would work is, let's say it's time to withdraw $10,000. Instead of getting $10,000 in cash, you would get an annuity worth $10,000 and then proceed to get your yield on the annuity, thus keeping your money in the system. If you look at the cash flows, and we've covered them numerous times before, if you look at the cash flows of where the money is and what the system needs to get to keep Social Security and Medicare payments coming, it's simply just a matter of, it's the Willie Horton problem. The IRAs and 401ks are where the money is. And so, yes, I continue to be nervous and continue to watch. I think it's unlikely that something would happen this year. That's going to take a real discussion. I think it's hard to do a midnight special passing that without anyone knowing it. You know, but if we get a real meltdown, anything could happen. Would you consider putting the interview with Clifford Carnicom in the public domain? For those who haven't heard the two interviews with Clifford Carnicom, I can't recommend them enough. They were absolutely wonderful. We're working to see if we can't put together not a full transcript, but notes. And while I'm not, we're not going to put it in the public domain, what we will do is make sure the notes are provided to you. And if anyone wants to forward it to their close friends and associates and family as an indication of why they should subscribe to the Solari Report, please feel free, because I think it is valuable information, and I would love to see you use it to help the people that you love. Great question. Central banks and infinite money, where's the end game? I'm going to hold that one for Franklin. GMO seems all bad. What is really happening? We're now working to get Jeffrey Smith as a guest on in the next 3 months. He's one of the leading experts on GMO. If you do a search for Jeffrey Smith and GMO, you'll pick up his website. There's wonderful DVDs and information, and I really encourage you to seek it out. Another interview suggestion, Dr. Gwen Scott, who's the naturopath who's been working with Clifford Carnicom. Yes, we are planning on getting her on sometime this year. Some great questions on the oil Gulf situation, which I'm going to defer until next week when we have Jim Norman on for the Gulf oil spill discussion. So great questions. Keep them coming. And we have numerous questions that are under review. We have a wonderful new development this summer. Mike Linton, professor of music. He's an expert on Bach from Middle State, Middle Tennessee State University, has agreed to be my production assistant. Thank you so much, Mike. And so I have him researching a group of your good questions that I do not know the answer to. So with that, it's time for the Precious Metals Market Report. Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Okay. What happened this week? Can you explain it?
Well, in a word, no.
I know how you feel.
I can't. The thing that the really weird thing was not that silver and gold came down, but that silver, everything else held, and silver did not. And you know, it's always dangerous to make excuses for a chart, because what that means is that you're trying to find some way to justify your bias in the face of what the chart says, and that's never a good idea. Sort of contradicts exactly the purpose of using a chart. But what happened was silver went down. It shouldn't have broken 1750, but it did. It went to 1720, and just as quickly came back up. I mean, it just, the chart looks like a fly crawling up a wall. I mean, it just goes
looks
straight.
Looks like a basketball to me.
Oh, yeah, it just goes straight up. Yeah, basketball bouncing off the floor, dropped from the top of the ceiling, and has behaved very well since. I don't know. It's so easy to say, well, it's manipulation, it's the government, or it's some kind of hedge fund raiders. It certainly might be. Somebody sold a bunch of silver at 1750 to drive it down, and it may have been no more than people on the floor who wanted to build their own position at a very low price. I mean, they do that, believe it or not. And silver, of course, being the smallest market, is very, very easy to manipulate. But what you see is you see a very strong, very bullish pattern coming up off of that bottom, and you see the same thing in gold. And even though the gold is, I understand, correcting right now, still, what we're seeing is patterns that are underlying, that are building underlying strength. And when I say building underlying strength, I mean building in gold, for instance, for a move of, from here, anywhere from $100 to $500. I mean, it could be an absolutely huge move, but it's not negative. You know, one of the indicators that I look at, probably the most sensitive indicator that I look at for silver, is what it costs to buy at wholesale, or what wholesalers will buy 90% silver for. And for the last 6 months or so, they would pay from 25 to 45 cents less than spot per ounce for 90% silver coin. So I watched it bump along 45, 40, 35 occasionally, 40, 45. And then suddenly a few weeks ago, it just started rising. And now it got up to a nickel under spot. Then it went to a nickel over spot and a dime over spot. And one of the things that I've learned watching the markets for 30 years is that premium is very, very sensitive to demand in the silver market. And generally speaking, when that premium stiffens up or strengthens, what it means is that the bottom has already come in silver, or a big move is building. Now, I understand this is the seasonal time of the year when silver and gold don't do well, and what we may see is another month or month and a half of prices, range-bound prices moving back and forth between 18 and 1850 or 1750 and 1850.
And what would that mean to gold?
Oh, 1190 to 1240, 1250.
Okay.
You know, I mean, they could move sideways that way, but both of them just seem so, they're tugging at the leash. They want to go higher. And I don't know what would stop them. Now, we discussed this. What's driving it? Is it the fear in Europe that the euro will come apart? Certainly, that's been part of it. Is it fear that there'll be a war with Iran? Well, maybe that's part of what is generating it too. The problem with that second thing is that our experience over the years, and I go back to Iran, the war with Iraq, for instance, gold ran up in the build-up to the war to Iraq, all of the saber-rattling that George Bush did and the threats. And gold kept building that whole time, but in the event, it dropped. When the event actually took place, it dropped. So crisis buying for gold does not drive gold over the long term. It may affect the market in the short term, but it does not drive it in the long term. What we're looking at is a market that is getting ready to, we've completed the first stage of the market's move up, the first of five stages. And the first stage has been corrected. And now we're beginning that second move up, and that is usually the wildest, or often the wildest and the fastest moving leg that we see. So what you're going to see between now and the end of the year is going to be very, very strong. Now,
right.
whether it begins at the first of August or first half of August and then takes off, or whether it begins in the summer, I don't know. I can't say. But I'll tell you that charts don't look weak. Silver does need to strengthen up some, but it just looks very, very good.
Well, if you look at the chart of the Dow in gold dollars,
mm-hmm.
what you're seeing is not, you're seeing a big drop,
mm-hmm.
but what we're looking forward to is not just something, in one sense it's called the repricing of everything,
mm-hmm.
because you're talking about enormous shifts between different places,
mm-hmm.
and different types of people and different types of assets. But it's not just the repricing of everything, it's the reinvention of everything. Because think about it, if you are an American and you're a member of the middle class for many years, you've been catered to, a group of politicians have catered to get your vote, and a group of companies have catered to get your purchase as a consumer. And now we're coming into a shift where they're saying, we figured out how to operate without you. We now control the computer voting machine, so the president election year can have a press conference and not use the American flag. And, and we can raise the wages in China and keep unemployment here going long term and have 20% plus people on food stamps and we can function without you as a consumer. And what that's saying is we're coming into a whole new paradigm of what life is going to be like in the first world countries. I mean, it's a fundamental change.
You mean
change.
As the first world countries are converted into third world countries?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that's their vision. Let's see what happens. But whatever it is, we're coming into a period of the repricing of everything. But to me, that's a symptom of the reinvention of everything. And I think people feel that and sense that, which is why so much nervousness about where do we put our cash. I should mention, we're working with our new teleseminar software. So if you'd like to ask a question online, the link is at your cart. Just go to the Instant Teleseminar website and feel free to ask a question online as we're talking. But let me just read you the question we have, Franklin. Thank you, Catherine Franklin, for answering my question a couple weeks ago. I found the advice to be very helpful. The follow-up question I have is, I purchased Position Your Assets in Uncertain Times, which is Catherine's audio seminar. It will be a good guide for the direction I'd like to go, but it is going to take some time to absorb and implement the information. I feel a sense of urgency to get things repositioned sooner rather than later. In the information written by Franklin, it seems I may be a bit out of luck on my 401ks due to the limited options. Franklin has been telling us to get out of stocks. I've been in cash for some time. I feel like I'm in an impossible situation. Are there options for those of us who are in this position, or are we just plain out of luck? In your opinion, is there time to learn what is needed to position our assets? Are there any other products you or Franklin offer that will address this situation?
Well, I'm not exactly sure I understand the question. Is the question, what do I do with this blinking IRA?
No. I think the question is, what does he do with his cash? And the fact is, without knowing his particular circumstance, there's too much that's unique to a person. So I never know how to answer this question without knowing a great deal about the person. So with that caveat, the one thing I would say is, I think the conundrum we're all dealing with is if we have a significant amount of money that's not in a 401k, the real question is, do you want to hold it in cash now, or is now the time? You know, this comes back to timing. Do you want to move it to precious metals? And if you don't want to move everything to precious metals, where is the high-quality fixed income where you can hold it? And I would just mention that my short-term strategy has been what I call the big chicken, which is really divided into, you know, your home base and tangibles, very high-quality fixed income, relatively short-term, and precious metals. So I think it's fair to say, Franklin, if we looked at your portfolio or my portfolio or most people's portfolio, I would say that you've invested the most in Franklin Inc. and I've invested the most in Catherine Inc. But away from that, we're very heavy in precious metals.
I don't know where else you can go. I mean, you could, you know, if it's very short-term stuff, who do you trust? The U.S. dollar is ridiculously bad. I mean, I know it's strong for right now, but basically it's an unbacked fiat currency, or it's backed by public confidence. Is the euro better? No, the euro's not better. The last few weeks have proved that. Is the yen any better? No, it's not any better. It's the same thing. So in my opinion, whatever money you leave in paper money, and not either in assets, income-producing assets, or silver or gold, is just wasted. And I think people, you know, one of the biggest problems that I've found is to get people to face the question, do I want to be partners with the government? Okay? And what you have to understand is, if you have an IRA, you are partners. You are the junior partner with the government in your IRA. And who controls the IRA? The government controls the IRA. Oh, yes, you may say, well, I'll take six of one and half a dozen of the other, but you can only choose from the menu that they provide.
Right.
So you have to ask yourself, is the 25% penalty, the 40% penalty, whatever it is that worth getting my hands on the money and getting control of the money? Because, I've said this until I'm sure y'all are tired of hearing it, but ownership has two aspects, title and control. When you are a partner with the government in an IRA, you have title. You do not have control.
Right.
And you have to ask yourself, how much is control worth to me in this world that I live in? Because in my opinion, you don't really have even the title. I mean, it's not your money if you can't control it.
Right. Although I find with different situations that it's not so black and white.
Mm.
In other words, there's some situations where it makes sense to leave and some where it doesn't. I mean, I will just say I don't have an IRA or 401k, and I never will again for the stories that I've described and published. But, I've seen situations where just taking it out today of an IRA is, you know, there's a smarter way to go about dealing with it.
Well, you know, you can start a precious metals IRA, and some IRAs offer, for instance, gold mutual funds. That's not my favorite alternative, but it's one. If you could buy a Central Fund of Canada, that's CEF on the New York Exchange, I would certainly buy that. I mean, you know, Central Fund just owns a big pile of gold and silver.
Right.
That's all they do.
They're on the Amex.
Is it on the Amex?
They're on the Amex.
Yeah. But I would own Central Fund of Canada. But the problem is that a lot of IRAs don't allow you to do that.
Right.
A lot of IRAs don't give you that choice. There are a few IRAs that give you the choice of buying so-called bear funds. The problem with bear funds in a down stock market is you have to be very, very patient, because the government is constantly manipulating uptrends. You know, they're constantly manipulating rallies. And even if the government weren't doing it, the characteristic of a bear market is that you find short sharp rallies occurring. And so you've got these, you know, periods of terror. And the stock market is a huge market. It's enormous. And it takes it a long time to turn and a long time to decline.
Right.
Generally. So, you know, if you buy a bear fund, if your particular IRA allows you to buy a bear fund, then you're going to be waiting a while for it to pay off.
See, I find ways of, you know, if your IRA won't let you do it, it's relatively easy to move to someone who will, or to get in a self-directed situation. The real problem comes in 401ks,
mm-hmm.
where you're flexible, your hands are really tied.
Right.
Okay, so the second question we wanted to look at is what's happening in the physical market. You know, you talked about what's happening with 90% silver. Did you want to say anything else, including what's happening at the, been happening at the U.S. Mint?
Well, and the Mint, of course, has been, had record years, because the demand is so great. But you had huge demand in Europe, and what that means is that where the premium in wholesale on sovereigns, let's say, or French 20 francs was $5, it's $10 to $15 now.
Right.
It's ridiculous. I mean, they've become so expensive that they're not worth buying. And we've seen premiums edge up on other things, but they've only edged up. They haven't really gone crazy. So what that indicates is that there's very, very strong buying under the market. It's not enough to empty the world out, you know, to empty out the pipeline, but it sure is enough to start putting pressure on those premiums to drive them up.
Now, let's say you had your core position in gold and silver. So let's assume that someone has a significant investment in precious metals, but they've decided because of the way things are going, they want to add to their position.
Mm.
What do they do, Franklin? Do they buy now or do they wait? With the seasonal patterns with us at summer lows?
Well, with the summer lows, I think, you know, it would not be unreasonable, which is the coward's way of saying it would be reasonable, to wait and see if you could get gold anywhere from 1200 to, oh, anyway, from 1195 to $1,215, or silver somewhere between 1780 and 1800. The problem is that the last few days' bizarre trading has made me wonder if that's going to happen or not.
Right.
So, I'd say anywhere you can buy toward the low end of the range, and we're now, you know, kind of in the middle of the range toward the low side with gold and sort of the same place with silver. You know, one of the problems that I see with people is they worry too much about that. I like to tell the story back, oh gosh, when silver had just gone through, this must be 8 years ago or so, gold had just gone through $300 for sure, gotten through 320 and run up to 340. And I was sweating bullets about whether or not it would fall back to 320 or 300. Which would it be? Would support at 320 hold? Well, look how ridiculous that looks today.
Right. Now, I remember.
Would you spend 340 for gold today? Of course you would.
I remember how hard I worked to, I had someone buying a big position and it just went over 400 and we had to pay over 400 and I was depressed for days. And I look back at it and I think, what was your problem? Okay, big issue that keeps coming up, Franklin, is storage options, because it's clear in this kind of environment that our recommendations has been consistently to move more and more into physical that you own and control. And of course that brings up the issue of, well, where do I store it? And there's so many different fact patterns. You know, you have people living in the cities, you have people with roommates, you have people in the suburbs, you have people who are way out in the country, you have all different kinds of age groups, people where there's somebody always at home. As Paul and I were driving over to Top of the World Farm, ladies and gentlemen, Paul Ferguson is the wonderful treasurer of my first ever Solari Circle, and he's down joining us this week at Solari Silver and Gold and came over with me for dinner tonight with Franklin. So we're driving and I was, you know, he was amazed at my ability to remember how to get to your farm, which is not really, it's, you know, behind this and across the stream. And and I said, now you see why Franklin thinks it's relatively easy to store precious metals at home. And so the issues of where do you store your silver and gold keep coming up. And I thought it would really be good if we could just review and revisit those options again.
Well, because silver and gold are the ultimate cash, the ultimate liquidity. The ideal place to store them is where you have 24-hour access. In other words, if you have to get up in the night, grab it and go, you can do that.
Right.
You can't do that if you store it in a bank.
Right.
Now, the advantage of storing it in a bank is, the bank takes the responsibility. I don't have to worry about a burglar breaking into my house. The silly thing about that is, though, we're all worried about burglars breaking into their house. I've never had one break. Well, no, that's not true. I had one break into my house. But most people have suffered far more loss from the gangsters in government than they have from any private gangsters at all.
Right.
And what does that fellow want who breaks into your house, you know, who smashes the lock or smashes the window and comes into the house? How long is he going to be there? 10 minutes? He goes to, looks for your jewelry box. He goes and looks through the coats in your closet, because that's where most people put their money. He looks in the freezers, because some people put their money there. Then he grabs the stereo, the microwave, and whatever else he can sell cheap, sell quickly, and he runs out of the house. He's not there long enough to tear open walls and try and figure out where you've hidden something.
Right.
So the best alternative is concealment construction. And by that, what I mean is that you look for a place that basically is invisible in your house, and you build in storage there. Let me give the example that comes to mind first. You've got a set of stairs in your house. You've got a closet underneath the stairs. At the back of the closet, it's not unusual for there to be a wall. If there's not a wall there, you build one there, and you build a wall that you can pull out easily that looks like it's nailed in, and you've got enough space behind there to store a king's ransom in gold. As far as silver is concerned, you know, when you're washing dishes at your kitchen sink, your toes are bumping up against the kick plate, which is that inset part it's the upright plate in the inset part of your counter. You can pry out that kick plate, and there's enough room back under there to put 6 or 8 bags of silver.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody knows they're there, and you don't have to get into them often enough that really makes much difference.
You got me using paint buckets.
Well, you know, that's one of my favorites. I read The Purloined Letter by Poe, and I can't ever get it out of my mind. But, you know, one thing that people do is they take paint buckets with, you know, old paint buckets, they clean them out, and then they put their silver, they put their silver in that, and put that at the back of their garage, where everybody's got a bunch of old paint buckets piled up anyway. Who sees that? That's invisible.
Now, if I don't want it at home, if for some reason I can't have it at home, what are my options?
Well, other than a local bank and a safe deposit box, let me give you a couple right here. In New Orleans, there's a place called the Security Center, and it's www.securitycenter.com. There's a fellow there named Bob Sykes, 504-587-2092. They offer safe deposit boxes or lockers up to walk-in vaults. They will receive and verify packages. So, in other words, if you wanted to buy $100,000 worth of gold and have it shipped to them, they will receive it and verify it and put it in your storage. But they do not make shipments, which means you would have to go to New Orleans to do that yourself. And they have boxes for like from $145 to $450 a year. They have bigger lockers that are $600 a year. They have walk-in vaults even that are $2,600 a year. But you see, the limitation on that storage is you've got to go to New Orleans to get it out. There is a company in outside Boise, Idaho, called Gold Silver Vault, and their website is goldsilvervault.com. Fellow there is Bob Coleman. They will receive and ship and verify. There is no regulation of the vault industry in Idaho. So you don't have to give them a Social Security number, tax ID. They're not regulated at all. The goods are insured by Lloyd's of London. Your property is fully segregated from everyone else's property. The storage fee is a percentage of the market value, and it's charged quarterly, and it amounts to 80 basis points of the value for gold and 77 basis points for silver. So what that means is if you had $100,000, you would have to pay $800 a year. $100,000 of silver would be $800 a year. $100,000 of gold would be $770 a year. But they have a $500,000 minimum. So that's not low. I know of one other institution, and I'm not allowed to say the name of the institution, but I will give you the phone number. And you can't get an account there except by invitation or referral. It's in the middle part of the United States. Minimum storage fee is a year. Minimum storage is a year. The fees are 1% a year, which is, $100,000. That's $1,000 a year.
It's expensive.
Well, it is, but it's, segregated storage insured by Lloyd's of London and private.
Right, and there's nothing to stop you from going around the world and getting a safe deposit box and putting precious metals in. However, it does subject you now, the new proposed regulations on the financial, what's called the FBAR filing, foreign financial institutions filing, is you've got to report it. So you put precious metals in a safe deposit box in a bank in Switzerland, which you can still do, then you've got to report it to the Treasury every June 30.
Right.
You've got to report the name of the bank account number, and how much you've got there.
Which is, again, one of the problems with storage.
Right.
Storage compromises your privacy.
Right.
There's no way around it. I talked to Bob Coleman this afternoon, and I said, well, in order for you to insure everything and guarantee it, you have to know what's in the account. Well, yeah, you do.
Right.
So, I'm not saying, I've already said, in my opinion, the very best way to store it is where you have 24-hour access. You personally have 24-hour access. If you can't do that, then you can consider one of these other things.
Now, one of the things I want to stress on storage is if you do store it at home, it is very important to keep a record of where you put it. Because Franklin, I laugh about this, but this happened to me with a whole pile of Cougar Ants. I forgot where to put it, and I would have sworn that wasn't possible. So it just goes to show you I have surmounted my concern with material possessions. But it's, what I recommend is to write down where you put things, keep a record, if anything, put it in code. If there's somebody you absolutely trust, let them know where it is. Because one way people do lose money on precious metals is they forget where they put them. It really happens.
Well, it's more generalized than that. People, very, very few people have written down in one place everything that they own.
Right.
That's one of the great frustrations for me for dealing with customers is they make it difficult to help them because they don't know what they've got. And so you've got to go through this whole inventorying process.
Later this year, we're doing the American Economics Institute has a wonderful book called If Something Should Happen. You can buy it on their online store. It's about $5 or $6, and it's literally just pages and pages of checklists of how to organize all your personal and financial affairs in case something should happen. Mm-hmm. Now we have a disaster recovery plan we're required by law. And that helped me tremendously do it, but I think it's invaluable. Okay, finally, we're doing a little series called The Top 10 Dates in the History of Gold and Silver. We talked about 1776, the convention, the American convention.
Constitution.
A constitutional convention, thank you, and the importance of that to the history of gold and silver. We talked about 1873 the last time, which was our second date.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've invited you to tell us your third date, and so take it away.
And we got into this controversy about which was the next most important date. You would think that the next most important date is 1913 and the establishment of the Central Bank, the Federal Reserve. And Maybe that's true, but to me, the question is, which is more important, the baby or the conception? I mean, when does the thing start? And if you think about the conception of the Federal Reserve, the embryo, the first form of the Federal Reserve came in the War Between the States in 1862. At that time, Lincoln needed some way to finance the war. And he not only passed the Greenback Act, but also the National Banking Act, which created a cartel, sort of a proto Federal Reserve. And the reason to create the cartel of banks, of course, was so that he could sell bonds. So the banks would sell bonds to finance the war. And then this was not just a wartime effort, because neither the Greenbacks nor the banking cartel disappeared after the war. And the banking cartel, we find, did exactly what it was supposed to do. It squeezed out of business all the state-chartered banks in favor of the national banks, because the federal government taxed the paper money, the notes that were issued by the state banks, but did not tax the notes that were issued by the national banks. And so the national banking cartel, the cartel that the National Banking Act created, continued up until the time that it was transformed into the Federal Reserve System by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. So those things go together. Now, it's very important to understand that the Hamiltonians, which were the Whigs in Lincoln's day, wanted a central bank. That was part of their threefold platform, and their threefold platform was public works for national improvement, which, in other words, building tracks for railroads, building canals, public improvements of all kinds, paid for at the taxpayers' expense, a high tariff, and a central bank. And this was Hamilton's program too. And Hamilton tried to start a central bank with the Bank of the United States. You know the hilarious story about them, of course.
Right.
But anyway, those things all fell through. And then the first and second banks of the United States. But Lincoln is the one who really solidified the national banking cartel with the National Banking Act and the Greenback Act. So that's really where the federal government took control of, or the banking industry took control of the federal government, I guess would be the better way to say
uh-huh.
it. That's when it really happened, and very few people realize that. Now, the interesting thing is that in the 1960s and 70s, the Federal Reserve made sure that all of the greenbacks were taken out of circulation. They're still authorized. They're, I don't know, $150 million, $200 million worth are authorized to be issued, and yet what the Federal Reserve has done is to pull almost all of those bills out of circulation. So they don't exist anymore.
We talked earlier about, leading up to this, essentially what I'm now thinking of as the East-West trading the gold-silver ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love if you could give us a little background on that and literally the shift of silver out of Britain and into China.
Well, the fact is that you can think of history as these flows of silver and gold back and forth between the East and the West, and it happens that silver will be undervalued at one place or the other, and it makes a huge difference. You could see it especially in the 17th century, when silver was valued at roughly 10 to 1 in China, and in Britain it was valued at 15 to 1. So what that, or 15 and a half to 1. So what that means is that 15 and a half ounces of silver bought an ounce of gold, or 1 ounce of gold bought 15 and a half ounces of silver in Britain, whereas in China it bought 10 ounces of silver bought 1 ounce of gold. So silver was either tremendously undervalued in Britain or overvalued in China. What happened was that after the Restoration in 1660, Charles I's government was extremely corrupt in England, and there was a law that prevented silver being exported from the kingdom. So through his mistress, Barbara Villiers, a faction belonging to the East India Company got a law passed that allowed them to take silver out of the country.
Now, I would like to say that just if you look at what happened with financial service reform and the amount of money spending on certain kinds of lobbying, to a certain extent, we can just underscore this and say nothing has changed.
Right, exactly. Except, well, the prostitutes are different. That's all. There are more prostitutes in Parliament now. But anyway, so they got this law passed, and they literally emptied England of silver. And think about it. You know, you take one boatload of silver to China, and you buy goods that even at wholesale are worth 50% more than you had to pay for them, and then you come back and sell them at a 200 or 300% margin. Why, it doesn't take long for your ship to get full.
Right, that's called Walmart.
Yeah, oh yeah, right. Exactly. It's the same kind of thing. But the Chinese wanted the silver because the Chinese were on a silver standard.
Right.
And didn't really have much use for the gold. So then I really think, we discussed this a little bit this afternoon, but the Opium Wars were part of Britain's attempt to balance their deficit of payments with India and the Far East by forcing the Chinese to take opium grown in India. And, of course, the Chinese imperial government refused to do that, didn't want the opium into their country, knew what it would do to their people. And so the British actually fought two wars to force the Chinese to smoke opium.
Right.
But the reason for that was that they were making plenty of money in the opium trade. So these flows of silver and gold, then if you come into modern times, what you see is that Roosevelt was actually partially responsible for the Communist Revolution in China in 1948, or the victory of the Communists in China, because in the 1930s, Roosevelt engaged in this nearly 10-year, I guess, 7-year manipulation of silver, in which he tried to manipulate the price of silver higher. Well, the problem with that was that China was on a silver standard still. So as he manipulated the price of silver higher, Chinese exports became more expensive. And eventually he just wreaked havoc with the Chinese economy and eventually forced China off of the silver standard.
That's why, to me, watching the patterns, that this effort that you see of the Western banks trying to get India and China to use exchange-traded funds, so they're buying paper and not physical, is such a critical issue. Well, Franklin, we're out of time. Thank you so much. We'll be back with you in July. And James Turk's going to be joining us.
Wonderful.
To talk about the international development. And I would just like to point out that I know Franklin Sanders because James Turk introduced us. So this is a homecoming. Okay, let's go to the movies very quickly. I put up a wonderful little news item by Rachel Maddow, basically comparing the 1979 Gulf oil spill with the 2010 Gulf oil spill we're watching today. The symmetries are chilling. I've said from the beginning that there are very strange aspects to both the spill itself and the response to the spill. And finally, I decided we have to get Jim Norman back next week to talk about it. I think it's a very important story, and it's an ongoing one. You have lots of great questions. We plan to answer them. July 1st, the second quarter wrap-up. July 8th, we're going to be back again with Franklin and James Turk. Keep placing suggestions at the cart with Mike's help. I hope to get your questions answered, all of them. So until next week, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.